We are Jim and Kathy McGinnis, and this session is entitled Solidarity with the Poor. For some of you that have not been here during the week at all, this series this week has been on what we've called a journey into compassion, which basically we've been talking about some of the aspects of spirituality that go along with social justice. And tonight, we're going to deal with one more aspect of that, and one of the most important and central aspects to the whole question of compassion, and that is solidarity with the poor, and probably one of the most difficult aspects of the journey into compassion. And we wanted to begin with a quote from Jeremiah that Jim's going to read.
It's pretty clear in the scriptures that God has a special love for the economically poor, and we can try to translate that into everybody's poor in some way, but you can't translate it that way. It's the economically poor. Though the gospel certainly is to be preached to everyone. And there are many places in the scriptures, Matthew 25, where Jesus identifies that service to the poor is not in a way, but it's exactly service to him. But in Jeremiah, in chapter 22, there's a very poignant statement where Jeremiah is chiding the young king, and he's comparing him to his father, who was also king. And he said, "Your father used to take up the cases of the needy and the poor, and all went well for him. Is not this what it means to know me?" It is Yahweh who speaks. Is not this what it means to know me? You cannot know me unless you identify with the poor. They are so special to me that you don't know who I am until you take up their cases in the way that I have taken up their cases. That's pretty direct. We cannot know God. It's impossible. Unless we know the people who are so special to God, the economically poor.
When we use the term solidarity, I don't know that there's any one absolute definition for it, but basically we're really talking about communion with the economically poor. We're talking about accompaniment of the poor, standing with, and advocacy for. Those are all some of the components when we use the term solidarity with the poor. And in today's world, and I know that you're probably familiar with a lot of the statistics about poverty, but what I wanted to do to begin us today was to read just a couple of statistics that I think are done in a little different way, that give us a little different picture. And if any of you are interested in this is a sheet that comes from the Children's Defense Fund, which I'm assuming many of you probably are familiar with. If you're not, it's one of the best groups to get updated information on poverty in the United States, especially poverty as it affects children in the United States, which now, of course, is the group that's the most greatly affected by poverty is children. This sheet is called One Day in the Life of America's Children, and it has a number of statistics. I just pulled out about five or six of them just to kind of read to you. But if any of you are interested in this, you can come and get one of these sheets afterwards. But just to give you a little idea of what they say, and this was done in the spring of 1990, so a year ago. All right. Every day in the life of America's children, 2,795 teenagers get pregnant. 1,849 children are abused or neglected. 1,629 children end up in adult jails. 689 babies are born to women who have had inadequate prenatal care. 67 babies die before 1 month of life. 105 babies die before their first birthday. And every day in the life of America's children, 135,000 children bring a gun to school. 1,512 teenagers drop out of school every day. And every day, 34,285 people lose their jobs, which obviously has an impact on children, even though children aren't the ones that are working. Now, those are just some, you know, some specific statistics. And I think that's one way to kind of look at poverty. Another is to look at a particular story. And this, there's a group in St. Louis called Project Respond, which put out a report this April addressing the needs of St. Louis children at risk. And I wanted to just read the little, they have a little story, little case study of Robert, age 4. So I just wanted to read that as a way of sort of fleshing out one of these statistics. Meet Robert. He's only 4 years old, but already he carries burdens heavy enough to stoop the shoulders and dash the dreams of a grown man. Robert lives in a tiny apartment over a bar on St. Louis's near South Side. His family is headed by his 20-year-old mother, who dropped out of high school when Robert was born. He also has a 2-year-old brother and an 8-month-old sister. The family rarely ventures out of the apartment, which is dark and cluttered with empty soda bottles and soiled clothing. They have no central heat. Because his mother feels the neighborhood is unsafe, Robert spends much of his day inside staring at television. While his favorite cartoons trigger laughter, the sound of footsteps on the apartment stairs make Robert cringe. His mother's boyfriend drinks too much. Twice in the last week, he has hit Robert, shouting that the boy was dumb and worthless. Robert's mother wants a better life for her children. She knows Robert, who was treated for lead poisoning as an infant, and his brother and sister are behind in their immunizations. Unfortunately, the children have not seen a doctor since the neighborhood clinic closed. Yesterday, Robert's mother called the WIC program, which I know a lot of you know this, is a special supplemental food program for women, infants, and children, and was told that current funding had run out. She could receive no service. Check back in six months, a voice told her. But what about today, she thinks. It's always difficult to secure the resources to keep the family together and operating. Sometimes it is impossible. Ever since she lost her job at a nearby laundry, she often finds herself depressed, thinking, what is the use? Robert does not use these exact words, but even at his tender age, he is beginning to develop a sense of hopelessness. His dreams extend only to the hope that his mother will one day buy him one of the toys he sees advertised on television. Robert's scheduled to begin kindergarten next fall. He will enter school with a number of developmental, academic, and social disabilities. He is unlikely, either in school or elsewhere, to receive the assistance needed to overcome the deficits imposed on him. His prospects for leading a reasonably comfortable, productive life are very dim. Now, that's the story of one child. That story could be repeated, and I know a lot of you know this, over and over again, and could be repeated in many different areas of the country. And that really is looking at U.S. poverty. Those statistics and that story are U.S. poverty. Then when you add to that the reality of poverty all around the world, then when we look at ourselves and say, well, now, all right, given all that sort of almost crushing reality, what do I do? What is my response to it? And that's what we wanted to really kind of spend our time with. And we have a worksheet called Solidarity with the Poor. We're going to start on this side that says Solidarity with the Poor for Reading Reflection. It has some quotes to begin with.
Those of you not used to Roman Catholic pastoral letters get a treat here. It's just to broaden your view.
Broaden your perspective. Even before we look at a couple of those quotes and some of the responses there, there's one other quote that we think it really is crucial when we're talking about what it means to be in solidarity with the poor. And this is from Leonardo Boff, who is a liberation theologian, and from something he wrote called When Theology Listens to the Poor. And I think it really puts in a very succinct, very short passage what it means to be in solidarity with the poor and what it does not mean. What he says is, we shall never be as the poor. We shall never sufficiently participate in their passion. At most, we can be their allies and bring up the rear. We can be committed to their cause, but never shall we be part and parcel of their crucified lives. And we are still learning. We must grow a great deal if we hope to reach their stature and deserve their communion. Which is kind of beautiful to me to think of how much we need to grow in order to deserve their communion. This sheet, I've got this quote on a sheet that we'll talk about later, and you can get it if any of you are interested in it too. The worksheet, the quotes that we put on there, the first two, which are probably pretty obvious to you, give a sense of the connection between the arms race, both domestically and internationally, in poverty from a couple of different sources. And then the other two just really are two other sources to sort of say strongly what the reason is for being in solidarity with the poor. But what we really want to concentrate on are down under B. We're not going to do this in a writing way, but what we're going to do is take those three categories, what we can do to be in solidarity with the poor in terms of direct service, in terms of our lifestyle, and in terms of social change and empowerment, the question of social change and empowerment. And we're going to throw out a few ideas in each one of those categories, talk about what that means, throw out a few ideas, and then see what your ideas are, what your experience has been, what your questions are in those kind of categories. The first one, direct service, obviously means working on behalf of people who are economically poor. And that's the area that we find is often an important, kind of an important first step for a lot of people, because it's a way of coming into contact. It's difficult to do direct service and not break down barriers between people. Now, you don't necessarily break down stereotypes when you do direct service, but you do break down barriers because you get to know people, as real people. Examples of that would be like working in a soup kitchen, going on service trips, and maybe going on service trips as a family. A lot of people do that. Families go to different areas of the United States or to third world countries. Working in food pantries, offering transportation to people, any kind of one-on-one relationships, working in nursing homes, taking meals to people that are in need of meals. Any of those kinds of things can be direct service, or can be organized, or can be just something that you do as an individual. Do you want to add something to that?
Celia
had to go.
How many of you have young children? A wonderful way to involve the kids in some of this is through these stuffed animals. This is just one real practical thing. I've been going to nursing homes and shelters for a number of years, and there's such a dearth of soft, cuddly things in the lives of both the kids in the shelters and the older people in the nursing homes that I visit, that these things really turn folks on. And it's something that children have lots of. It's something that they can give. And when your children feel uncomfortable walking into a new environment like that, it's really helpful if they go with a friend. But it's also very helpful to go with a thing, because it gives them something to talk about. It gives them something of themselves to give. Now, that's a one-way street. But it's the wonderful thing that the child can give that can work many miracles. And this little stuffed animal has worked many miracles in 5 years. The other thing, though, is to be really careful that it's a reciprocal relationship and not just a giving relationship. I think that's one of the important things about the service. It's not doing for so much as doing with. There's got to be an exchange. You've got to help the other person feel more gifted and not just more needy. So one of the things that you can do in a one-on-one relationship is to really find out that person's story. And there's nothing like a little child sometimes to help unlock somebody talking about themselves, particularly if it's an older person in a nursing home, because there's a real bonding, I think, that can take place across generations like that. But just whenever we are doing direct service, I think it's really important to remember to make it as mutual or reciprocal as possible, and not just a one-way giving kind of thing.
What about questions or concerns or things that you'd like to add in terms of direct service?
Sure. Well, how can you do that in a food bank situation or pantry type, you know, food pantry? Or I don't see how that can be. You are giving. You are.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Well, it can be. If you involve the recipients in the distribution, because you can do that, if there's a board that makes policy, make sure you involve some of the recipients in the making of the policy. If you can be there when food is given out and go out of your way to, you know, to just strike up a conversation with somebody, and if that person comes back regularly, maybe a friendship can develop. And then maybe out of that friendship, that person then begins to become part of your family or part of your life, and then lots of reciprocal things can happen. But no, just the act of donating food, there isn't a reciprocal dimension, but you can turn that situation into one that's more reciprocal.
Other questions or concerns or examples you have of direct service or ways that you've seen it make a difference to yourself or to other people?
Meals on Wheels is one thing that I've done, and I've noticed that it becomes hard to do that reciprocating type of thing with the people, because you start out on the route with their food, you go to them, and they want to strike up a conversation. That may be the only interaction they have with someone during the day. But then you get to the last one and say, boy, you're a half hour late today. That you've got to balance that out a little bit.
Maybe you have to go back on your own time.
Yeah.
To one person. Not trying to do it to everybody. But maybe you single out one that you go back to on your own time.
I think one of the concerns that people sometimes raise about direct service has to do with how well we prepare ourselves and prepare other people, and particularly prepare children for it, and then how well we debrief it, the experience. An example of that I was involved with, I was talking with an eighth grade teacher. She had taken some of her students. She wanted to do something more than just have the kids bring clothing in at Thanksgiving time for the traditional Thanksgiving clothing drive. So she decided that it would be important to have some of the kids go with the teacher to deliver the clothes. They did that. She said when we got to the home, Their father was there in the home. He was sitting at the kitchen table. She said he was just sitting there. He was watching television. And when we came in, he didn't seem happy to see us. She said he didn't smile. He didn't say thank you. He barely acknowledged the fact that we had come in. And she said afterwards, the kids said to me, well, why was he just sitting there? Why wasn't he out looking for a job? Why wasn't he nicer to us? Why didn't he thank us? Why wasn't he happy to see us? And she was saying, I think they were right. He should have been out looking for a job. And I think he should have been more grateful to us. And it struck me at the time that was an opportunity, I think, for those eighth graders to gain some kind of empathy about what it would be like to be the father of a family and to have other people bring in clothing or bring in food to take care of your family, to feel at that moment, feel very dramatically that sense of powerlessness, which is so key to poverty. And also it would have been an opportunity to talk a little bit about the job situation in the city and what it's like to try to get jobs and how people get discouraged and things like that. But even beyond that, to just deal with the feeling thing. And I think sometimes when we do direct service, one of my concerns is that we can, especially with kids, that they can kind of, you know, they'll say, well, why don't people fix up this neighborhood? Why don't they pick up the things on the street? Or why don't they paint that front porch? Or why don't they fix those steps? Or whatever. That it really is an opportunity to besides sharing some of the economic realities about how, you know, what does it mean to try to fix steps? Or what does it mean to try to buy paint and paint your house? And they don't own the house, and who owns it? Those kinds of things. To also give them a little sense of the feelings that are part of it, too.
That presumes that you've worked that out yourself.
Yeah.
How did
you do that?
Yeah.
Right? That teacher hadn't.
Yeah. And I know that nobody in my experience had until I was well into my 20s. Mm-hmm. So let's keep going on.
Yeah.
That so far what I hear you saying presumes a lot of what our society is very, very efficient on. Like, how do I become prepared enough to share that with Celia, which is 4 years old?
Yeah, you mean deficient in, like, social analysis?
Yeah.
Or so. Well, both social analysis and also empathy.
Empathy.
Also a real ability to get in somebody else's shoes or to feel the way somebody else feels.
If we've never been fired, how do we know what it's like to do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that fun, but it is kind of an experience to go through.
That's the basic principle, in a sense, we've been operating on all week, and that is our concern for an issue area is directly dependent upon the degree that we have a personal stake and a personal relationship in that area that can help us really see. Until we can really truly understand or hear the stories of someone who has been through, who is a victim of poverty, we tend to blame the victims. It's only as we begin to know, it doesn't mean that they're blameless, but we tend to blame people for their poverty. And I think it's until we truly get to know people who have walked that journey and to see the obstacles that most of them are up against that we have any kind of understanding and then can be a good teacher or interpreter for others. But if we don't have those personal relationships and know those stories, we're...
But part of it, I mean, given that when you look around and you don't see a place to get that kind of insight, part of it is just to go and to do it wrong and to fall down, get up, try again,
And part of what makes that possible is if you can do it as a group, you can do it with one other person, so that you can see more, compare notes. If you're working with kids in a youth group setting, don't send the kids out one-on-one, send them out in groups of two or three at a time, get them talking to each other. Don't take your family by yourself, go with another family so that the kids have a little bit more, makes it more fun, also gives them a little more security if they're moving into an unknown situation. Even for adults, I think it helps. We're sometimes insecure moving into a new world.
Well, if you can't find someone else to, at least your family is a group.
Yep.
think we have to realize too that a lot of these people out of work, when they've had poor nutrition, they're just not up to needing a new job or even to ask for a new job. They don't have, well, all their living wages.
Yeah, I think that's why one of the reasons I started with the whole idea of children, because I think that when we, if we focus on children, and of course nutrition comes very much into their reality, that can be a way sometimes for people to develop a little more empathy, because even if people say want to blame adults and say, well, this adult is in this situation because of choices that he or she made, it's hard to blame a four-year-old for that reality. And sometimes to, it, like if we're working with people on an educational model, or we're trying to work with ourselves to kind of raise our own consciousness or continue to raise it, to focus on children seems to be a way of doing that. When you talked about nutrition, that really triggered that for me, because that has such implications in terms of where kids are when they start school and what's going to happen to them from then on.
It seems, as you talk also, that children on the side of the going to it for, the side of providing solidarity, are more inclined to want to make the linkages with the actual people. When one of my daughters was three, we had a little mitten tree at church at Christmas. My daughter also needed mittens. So when I bought the pair of mittens for the mitten tree, I bought a pair of the same mittens for my three-year-old. And she hung them on the mitten tree, the pair for the poor, and wore her pair. And I forgot about it. And about 3 months later, we're in the lobby of the bank, and this little girl walks in wearing a pair of mittens, just like my little daughter's. All of a sudden, with this really loud voice, she looks at me and says, "Mommy, Mommy, is that the poor?" And I had to really scramble to figure out what she was talking about. You know. But suddenly, she just held up her little hand. And I thought she was more inclined to want to make a linkage with the recipient of those mittens than I was. I was really content to hang on the tree and be done with my fine act. And she was looking for those mittens. I was just struck by how much that mattered to her, the connection.
The sister church that might be good to mention in this context, don't you think?
Sure. This sheet that Jim just was mentioning is something put out by the Baptist Peace Fellowship, and it kind of relates a little bit to the idea of the connection between churches too. It talks about how to start and sustain a sister church relationship. It could be a sister church relationship in the United States, or it could be an international sister church relationship, but it's always done with a real respect for and a real sense of learning from the other. So, I don't know,
people want it, they can take one.
They can take one, we'll just put it
about
over
37 there. Different ideas on how to make these things work. Yeah. And you can grab one at the end if you want.
How do you find out about resources for like the action service trips that are appropriate for children, their families with children?
Well, your own church, might have some.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in touch with community service agencies, you can find out lots of things. Lots of cities have houses of hospitality, or, you know, I should say, have the soup kitchen, provide sanctuary. You just have to start asking around.
Yeah. I would think in each community.
Don't be afraid to get blank stares.
Yeah.
I was thinking more of the trips. We talked about trips.
Yeah. Well, a number of those are also organized through churches, and then in different communities, like we have a Haiti project in St. Louis. It's not a church project, but it's one that high school and college kids and families go on. They go down and actually do a lot of service in Haiti for several weeks. But let's move to talk about lifestyle. Another dimension, I think, of how we respond to the poor. means that we look at our own lifestyle, and that means we take, I think, take a critical look at our possessions, at how we live, how we spend money, how we entertain, how we celebrate, how we gift other people. Kind of looking at decisions about how much we have and then about how we use what we do have. And I think both of those things are important. We have some friends in St. Louis, and I think of them often because they're people that have a good deal of money, and they have a house in the country, a second house in the, like in the country outside the city of St. Louis. And they really went through a lot of discernment about, should we do this? Should we have this house? And what they came up with was that the only way they felt they could have it, justify having it, is if they really made it open to other people. So it's become kind of a, besides their own family using it, and they have a huge family, it's become kind of an open place for small groups to do retreats, and for people who are economically poor, for a number of church groups to bring kids out and have an experience, overnight experience in the country. And so it's been a way for them to be, I think you'd call it like stewards, kind of like how can you be a steward of the resources that you do have, and this is one way to do that. Do you want to talk about fasting in that context too?
Again, my conviction is that we're not going to move deeply into this area apart from a personal relationship, and I think also without some degree of sacrificial action on our part on a regular basis. I think we dabble until we pay a price. And I think that paying of a price doesn't have to be a huge price, but I think it has to be a regular price to pay. Writing a check at the end of the month to support a project in Peru, that doesn't hurt anything. But if that money wasn't generated by some sacrificial action on my part, it would not have the effect. And I don't know whether there would be a growing sense of solidarity. I want to give you an example that hit me between the eyes almost a year ago. I had the good fortune in 1982, Kathy and I were in Nicaragua for a while, and I went on to Peru, and I was living on a hillside in Lima with a priest friend, a Marian old priest, who decided not to live in the parish house, but to go up on the hillside in the little squatter's shanties and to live with the people. And I got to go up into Tom's home and spend 2 or 3 days with him there on the hillside. And I was reading an article that Tom was writing about his people in September in a magazine, and he was talking about one of his parishioners named Mary, one of his neighbors, who had come to him and said, "Father, my neighbor stole all my food." And I found out who it was, and I went and confronted her, and she said, "Mary, my children are dying. I didn't have any choice. The parish did not have any more food in their food bank. And the community food bank was empty." And she said, "My children were literally starving, and I didn't see anything else I could do." And Mary said, "What do we do, Father?" And Tom said, "I don't know what we do." I read that 5:30 in the afternoon, sitting on our back porch, drinking my second beer of the evening. And I couldn't finish the beer. I just saw this tremendous contradiction between my lifestyle and that reality. And because I lived there for a few days, because I knew the people that Tom was writing about, I just felt this, I think, liberating call to look more seriously at how I was living and to say, what can I do every day? And I just, within the next hour, I just decided that I was going to try every day to free up a dollar. Different kind of transportation, letting go of a beer, letting go of a snack, not buying something secondhand, but to try and generate as many days as possible, and I've not done it every day, but I do it many days. I figure out a way of saving a little bit of money so that that $30 check at the end of the month that goes to Tom comes out of the sacrifices or the creative living, the creative decision making on a regular basis. But because it's regular, I know something's happening inside of me. If it was just a $30 check at the end of the month without the creative sacrificial dimension, I don't think it would have an impact. And I don't know how long it would last. And I continue to challenge myself not to feel guilty about what the relative comforts that I have, but I want to challenge myself, and I want to ask you to challenge yourselves. Is there a way that we can live a little more consciously of how others are living, and do it regularly, and then generate some savings, and then transfer that savings to one person or one group that we can then think of regularly, pray for regularly, and when it's tough to make those sacrifices, to think of them so that they help to motivate us. I mean, I make sacrifices for people I love. I don't make them for an abstract issue. I don't make them for statistics. I don't make them for 3,432 kids. I make it for Mary and Tom, but not 3,432 kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I just really ask you to think about focus and sacrifice. And is there a way of putting those two together at this point in your life? Where would you focus and what kinds of sacrifices could you make on just the little teeny tiny things on a regular basis? And then maybe if you live with other people, it can become a family affair. And one of the neat things we have is we have a little World Bank that sits on our breakfast table sometimes where you can actually plunk the money into that you're saving, if you're saving it by way of what goes on at the dinner table. It's called the World Bank. You can get those. It's a different kind of World Bank.
Good grade.
But I don't know. I throw that out for you to wrestle with, to challenge, to offer your own examples. Where does that strike you? How does that strike you?
Well, we're our neighbors and we're obligated. Because anyone who is a neighbor is our neighbor.
You've seen Shopping for a Better World in the bookstore? That's a great little guide.
That's an indispensable thing to have with you when you're going into a supermarket. Mm-hmm.
That ranks all the corporations that provide, most of the corporations that provide almost all the things that most people use, consumer goods. And it ranks them on 10 different criteria, ranging from environmental protection to disclosure of information to contributing to the local community, or are they involved in South Africa or nuclear weapons development. It's 10 criteria, and they rank them good, and they tell you how they rank on each of those criteria. So you choose the ones that make sense to you, and they say, are they good fair or poor on each criteria. So that you just get a sense of who you're supporting when you spend your tax dollars. On the back of the sheet, turn over, look at number 3. If you're interested in consumer boycotts, there are 2 sources for regular updating.
Number 3 on the bottom.
On the bottom.
Yeah, Co-op America.
So you got 2 different sources for boycott information, other than what you might get out of your own.
The National Boycott News is a gigantic tabloid, like a 200-page tabloid. It comes out every time they get enough money to put out the next edition.
Shopper's Guide.
It's not Shopper's Guide, no.
The Shopper's Guide for Better, but that's put up by
Council on Economic
Priorities. Council on Economic Priorities. The interesting thing about the National Boycott News, one of the interesting things is they attempt to give both sides of every issue. They always write to the company that's being boycotted and ask for their response, and then they print that response. So it's it is a kind of a both sides, the people that are calling for the boycott, why they're calling for, what groups are calling for the boycott, and then the company responds in terms of how they feel about the boycott. So
that makes it great when you go to your own congregation and try to enlist them. Because then when you do a public education thing in your congregation, you gotta have, you know, obviously both sides.
What was the name of that Shopper's Guide?
For a Better World.
Is it on this list?
No, it's not, but it's in the bookstore.
It's right by the cash register, right on the desk by the cash register. They have some copies of it.
One very interesting way to approach this lifestyle question, or one strategy to avoid accumulation, which I think is part of the problem. A family told us that they have 5 teenagers, and they came to this, they set up what they called the exchange system in their house. And that was whenever you brought something new into the house, something used in that category had to go out to somebody else. So if you bought a new sweater, you chose an old sweater to give away to somebody who didn't have it. If you buy a new appliance, is there an old appliance that you could share? If you get a new recreational item, is there an older recreational item that you could give away? And to whom? And a new toy, then an old toy goes out. It's a neat way to avoid accumulation. It's a good way to kind of, in a sense, be regularly conscious of our solidarity with others who have much less than we do. Saves drawer space. What do you think?
I'm very troubled by that one.
Right?
How can you do that without avoid people believing that I deserve the newer and the best and someone else deserves my leftovers?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a step. Mm-hmm. Step. Most people don't do that.
But yeah, that is a problem with it, though.
You may not do it directly, you can do it through a thrift shop, because they do supply much for many of the people, many needs that poor people have, at a very low price.
But that still doesn't get beyond that idea that for some reason I deserve the new things and somebody else deserves
them. Well, shop at a thrift shop.
Yeah, it could be that you bring in a new thrift item from a thrift shop, and then something.
And maybe when I shop at the thrift shop, I should look at those bargains when it was a half price. You know, and the thrift shop is giving 50% discounts. Mm-hmm. I just say, my God, look, I got 4 shirts instead of 2 today. And didn't even think that, well, maybe that savings I have not to keep. Maybe I should pass that savings on. I didn't even think about that. But it does kind of orient us to sharing the savings, sharing the extras, at least.
When one does attempt to get praised of different boycotts and different issues, according to the Shopper's Guide, for example, and then confronts the reality of a new refrigerator, then it can get fairly bizarre to choose between GE and a manna, which is owned by Raytheon, and you know, all these different things.
Sure. We're caught. I mean, you're never going to be clean. We're never going to be clean. We just have to know that we live in a web of sinfulness.
The human condition.
The human condition. That's it. And we just do the best we can, one step at a time. We don't go crazy looking at 97 different choices, you know, different consumer items. Hey, you start with one, realizing that you're caught, but we move one step at a time, and maybe we can't come up with a clean alternative, but maybe it can be better than the one we were doing before. And if we use those opportunities to write the letters to explain to the different corporations that we choose to or choose not to deal with anymore, explaining to them why, then we're sharing our prophetic voice a little bit.
And so I think there's always kind of compromises in that, too. I remember a number of years ago when we were doing some reading on the whole issue of bananas and the growing of bananas in the Philippines, particularly, and we're more aware of that and the exploitation, and therefore the bananas we buy are at a lower cost, that kind of thing. And we started talking about maybe we shouldn't eat bananas because that's an exploitive kind of thing. And one of our kids was just so wild about bananas, you know. And so we ended up deciding that whenever we bought a banana, we would put, we figured out like a penny or something in a little can, and when we got to a certain amount, we would send that back to people we knew that were working in the Philippines with the workers, sort of a way of
taxing.
Yeah, kind of a taxing, voluntary surtax or something.
Or a way of just being equitable with what somebody in the Philippines would have to pay for that banana.
Yeah.
But it was a consciousness-raising thing that helped our kids at the time. I mean, it lasted for about a year, and we didn't continue to do it. But for a year, our kids were more conscious that each banana had a price. We enjoyed that banana. It was, a little bit at somebody else's expense. And so let's plow back into the system that benefit that we had. Even though we didn't take it from them, let's give it back.
That's true with so much food, so many different kinds of food.
One thing that disturbs me is our government's insistence on having free trade with Japan on their rice situation. That would put a lot of their people in a bad situation. How do you approach something like that? That would increase a big problem there for their poor people. And why is it so necessary we have to raise so much rice?
Sure. Rice farmers have a powerful lobby in California. They've been there for a long time, and the rice farmers in Louisiana, they have a powerful lobby there.
Well, how do you approach these things?
Well, you, there's nothing you do on your own. I think you work through organizations that have begun to take on issues like that. You know, because, I mean, a lone letter on an issue like that out of the blue is not going to mount anything. So you try to find out, is there a group in the country dealing with that issue? If there isn't, I mean, just to be practical, I think you have a limited amount of time to devote to political work. So I think you put it into an area where there is a group dealing with it, where you got some chance of making a dent somewhere. And in the other situations, you just kind of say, well, hey, it's not right, but I don't know what to do. You can write that lone letter if you want to, but I just think we have a limited amount of time to write letters. So that's like a group like Bread for the World, some of the groups on the back here that National Impact. I mean, I would say in an issue like that, I would contact National Impact, because that's an ecumenical, actually it's interfaith, organization in Washington, D.C. that covers a wide range of poverty issues in the U.S. and overseas. And I would just say, is there anybody dealing with this issue? What are you all doing back in Washington? Because that's as close to lobbying as you're getting out of the churches on international issues. And you could find out if they're moving on that particular one. If they're not moving on it, you might suggest that they consider it. Yeah. But that's how I would work. I would work through a group like National Impact on an issue like that.
Well, collective prayer, though, should help, too.
Yeah, sure.
When you said there's nothing to do alone, except prayer.
Sure. And I think, again, the more we lift up in prayer the people on whose behalf we are working, I think the more serious the more seriously we're involved in the process, the more deeply we go into it. I just know the difference. Kathy and I and our family and two other families in St. Louis are part of a project. Were you going to talk about that?
No, you can't.
Well, it's both direct service, empowerment, and lifestyle change. It's all three. But it's a women's center in Mulucacu, Nicaragua. It's a little village in Mulucacu. 1,400 people. They formed their village because of the Contras harassing them in the countryside, in the hillsides. They came and created their village in 85. In 88, a hurricane came through and completely destroyed the village. All but 35 houses were totally demolished, and they're rebuilding from scratch. And in the new village, it's 36 women who are leading they're the organized women who are leading the rebuilding of the community, and this women's center is their dream. And they asked us to be a partner in the realization of that dream, and they are telling us what to do. It's a beautiful project in terms of the empowerment, and they are directing it. It's not the North Americans telling them what they need. But the thing that touched me the most, we got a letter just before Christmas from Gretel, the woman in charge of the project. And then she just said in a very simple letter, "You people are the manifestación, you are the manifestation of God to us." And we just said to ourselves and back to Gretel, "Gretel, you are the manifestation of God to us." But I just think about that, and I think of every day of praying with Gretel and her husband Noel, and having them as the focus, just having them, that specific project and those people as the focus for our fasting, our sacrificial action, our community work, trying to raise money for a truck and for the center and raising children's sports and school supplies and getting medical supplies for the health clinic part of the center. But it's because we have gotten to know Noel and Gretel, and I think it's in part that relationship grows through daily prayer and sacrifice on their behalf. And so I think that prayerful dimension is really important. I think having a project like that for your church and for your family, for yourself, to be connected with a very specific project, a very specific group at the other end. That's why the sister church idea, I think, is so good. Where you are working on something concrete together. Because you know when you can give a concrete story and concrete needs and concrete ways in which we can benefit from them, as well as ways we can benefit them. I think people respond to that. They don't respond to the abstract need as much as they respond to the specific group and the specific need. And if you're interested in this particular project, if you don't have one of your own and you like it, like the sound of it, let us know afterwards. We'll get you on give you a newsletter and link it to
put you on a mailing list for it.
Our son David is in Mexico right now driving the truck to the village. He should arrive in a couple of weeks, which we were really tickled about. It's so neat to see one of the kids grab a hold of something and go with it.
Yes.
He's got to go through Guatemala,
Salvador.
Salvador.
Yeah. They're going through Salvador and Honduras, I think. Mm-hmm.
Because it was a specific project. Yeah. Because David got there one time. Because he was touched by the people. He wanted to go back. He gave up a whole summer of work to go back. And this kid doesn't give up money for anything. He didn't give up for a Notre Dame football game in the fall. He wouldn't go to a Notre Dame football game because he didn't want to miss a weekend of work. But he gave up his job for the whole blinking summer so he could spend a month driving a truck to Nicaragua. So you know that kid was touched. And he doesn't do that kind of stuff at home. But he was moved, and he was moved by the people. And he saw how they were struggling. Gretel is the manifestation of God for us. And Gretel manifested God to David. And David's a different person. Yeah.
He might not say it that way.
He won't say it, but that's what's going on in David's life.
Well, the Holy Spirit had a strong part in
that. Oh, he sure did. She sure did.
Yeah. We've only got a minute or two more. Well, we've been talking about that third step down there, the social change and empowerment. But on the back side, I just wanted to point out a couple more resources that we hadn't had a chance to mention yet. That on the top, under number 4, the empower the poor economically, the resources, actually the resources for that are number 5 on the bottom half of the sheet. And a lot of you are very aware of these resources, I think, the Third World Handicrafts. That's a particularly good starting point for churches, I think, because many people will get involved in that who haven't done any kind of social analysis yet or have all sorts of, but because generally the handicrafts are beautiful items, people are very willing to do that. And to get a gift shop started in a community that sells that can be a really, that's a way of doing empowerment and getting people involved in something that they understand and that they can connect to. So that's, I think, a particularly good resource.
You can bring these stuff in yourself.
It, you know?
Most of these groups will give you some of the stuff on consignment to take to your own church. Yeah. But you can make it part of its Christmas or the November holiday kind of thing that you put on in your local church. Add these.
And the only other thing that we didn't mention specifically, under number 4 on the bottom where it says resources for these steps, the whole issue of prisoners, I think, when you're talking about poverty, is a very real one because people in prisons tend to be people who are economically poor. And these groups will provide you with names of people, and often churches also have names of people that could be written to, or some churches have projects for families to be supportive of families of people who are in prisons. That's another way, I think, to stand with sort of that solidarity question. Doesn't mean you have to like what they've done, perhaps, but a lot of people are in prison because they got very desperate and had very few choices.
A lot of people are in prison because they started out like corrupt as a little boy.
Yeah.
And if you can get past the blame issue and think of what kind of a life this person has had, they were a child or not led them
to where they are. Yeah.
And get past the blame and get to the blame.
I think we need to stop in terms of the timing. If any of you want that One Day in the Life of America's Children, the statistics are the sister church.
Or if any of you are concerned about the victims, the civilian casualties in Iraq.
Oh my.
Where we have a direct hand in that. The Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is trying to help civilian victims in Kuwait, Israel, Jordan, as well as Iraq, but especially in Iraq, has a civilian casualty fund, money and medical supplies. And I just, FOR is one of those groups that I have tremendous respect for, and they're getting the stuff over there and into the hands of people. They're working through the Jordanian and the Iraqi Red Crescent, the equivalent of the Red Cross. So if you're interested in that particular group of the poor at this point in time, I recommend you take one of these descriptions of the Civilian Casualty Fund from the Fellowship of Reconciliation.
Is that also included from World Relief?
I don't know if they're involved in that or not.
They good.
Thank
good.
You.
Well, I'm glad to know that Lutheran World Relief is involved
good.
Too. No, it doesn't include that. That's a different group altogether.
Thank you.